You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Boulder Weekly, read by Bill Bass. Today we will be reading the following main articles. When Victimhood Masks Power, Protesting Israeli Policies is Not Anti-Semitism. When Does Criticism of Israel Cross a Line? A Primer on Anti-Semitism and Anti-Zionism. A Big Statement. Colorado Music Festival approaches half a century with robust program of contrast. And following up with miscellaneous articles. From the opinion section, When Victimhood Masks Power, Protesting Israeli Policies is Not Anti-Semitism, by Misha K. Ben-David. At the Boulder Jewish Community Center, JCC, vigil for the attack on the Israeli march, when the crowd sang Hatikva, the national anthem of Israel, a state raising Gaza, I didn't hear healing, I heard nationalism. Some may see Hatikva, written in the 1800s and considered an unofficial Jewish anthem before Israel adopted it in 2004, as a simple expression of Jewish pride. But it's not. It's the national anthem of a foreign country carrying out occupation, ethnic cleansing, and genocide. I was ashamed, not of grief, but of the pageantry, the self-congratulation, the refusal to acknowledge the blood being spilled in our name. This wasn't an apolitical act of mourning. It was a pro-Israel rally in an all-but-name, complete with the Israeli consul general and rabbis wearing Israeli military dog tags on stage. You can't publicly celebrate a military campaign and then cry anti-Semitism when there's backlash. That's not how accountability or words work. As an Israeli veteran, I've stood at checkpoints, broken into homes, and detained people who vanished into Israel's military prison system without trial. The occupation is not theoretical. It is daily, dehumanizing domination, and it is ugly. The JCC was packed, to the point that Boulder County Commissioner Marta Loschman and Senators Judy Gonzalez and Iman Joda, who showed exceptional courage in attending as a Palestinian woman offering her sympathies, were herded into the gym like political footnotes. Clergy, Governor Jared Polis, the state director of the Anti-Defamation League, ADL, and every public official with a speechwriter took turns naming this violence anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is real and terrifying, but calling every act of anti-Israel resistance, including violent ones, anti-Semitism, flattens reality, distorts public discourse, and blocks urgently needed accountability. We can't afford to conflate identity with ideology or use fear to silence debate. It erases the distinction between Jewish identity and Israeli state violence, and it's designed to end the conversation before it starts. Boulder City Council member Taisha Adams, Boulder's only current black elected official, a consistent, courageous voice for peace and justice, was notably absent. Knowing her presence would distract from the vigil, Taisha walked Pearl Street checking in on business owners and their staff. To me, her absence wasn't incidental. It was an exclusion. Even here, those who refuse to toe the political line or push to the margins, their integrity treated as disruption. It's yet another reminder that for all the talk of community, only some voices are ever truly welcome. And then there was Linda Amin Badwin, a compassionate Palestinian woman from Jerusalem who lives here in Colorado. She sat beside me in solemn solidarity, holding in her heart the weight of upward of 70,000 Palestinians killed in Gaza since October 2023, including over 15,000 children. More than 245,000 homes have been destroyed or damaged, leaving nearly 1.8 million people displaced. Essential infrastructure, over 136 schools and universities, 823 mosques, 3 churches, and more than 200 government facilities, flattened. The United Nations estimates that clearing the rubble alone could take over 2 decades. Baldwin and Senator Joda's steady presence said more than any podium could. In the face of unimaginable grief, they showed up for hours. Was the June 1st attack violent? Yes. Do I condone it? Of course not. And I say that not as an armchair activist, but as someone who had several Molotov cocktails thrown at my head. I know what fear feels like. I know the heat, the confusion, the adrenaline. I also know that the people who threw them at me weren't monsters. They were people reacting. Desperately, sometimes violently, to a system that brutalized them daily. Expressing sorrow for this attack while ignoring the far greater violence done in our name isn't empathy. It's complicity. That's a hard truth, especially for those of us raised to see our identity as inherently righteous. But so long as we remain silent, the blood is all on our hands. My heart aches for the Israeli hostages, every one of them. Every family waiting in silence, rage, fear. They deserve to be free. Just as every Palestinian family deserves to live without occupation, without bombing, without checkpoints or midnight arrest. One pain does not negate the other. One truth does not cancel another. What makes us human is being able to hold them together. As we grieve for hostages, we must also reckon with the over 9,000 Palestinians who remain detained in Israeli prisons, many without charges or trial. Their families often don't know where they are or if they'll return. Somehow, only one side's grief gets amplified. It's wild to me that after all the violence I've committed in uniform, I still get a pass. I still get invited to speak, to mourn, to be seen as a person. But others, who've lived under that violence for generations, get reduced to monsters the moment they lash out. I don't say any of this to excuse harm. I say it because I think how we talk about harm matters. Accountability isn't the same as erasure. When Governor Polis declared, "There is no room for hate in Colorado," I wanted to believe him. But it didn't sound like a promise. It sounded like a boundary. Like some hate, against Jews, is condemned, while other hate, against Palestinians, Muslims, or those who challenge Israeli policy, remains unchallenged. That kind of hate thrives, earning handshakes and standing ovations. This selective outrage doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's fueled by a broader political climate shaped by Christian Zionism, rising authoritarianism, and far-right alignment. There are more Christian Zionists than Jews in the U.S., and their influence on U.S. policy toward Israel is massive yet rarely named. After the attack, Boulder City Council suspended public comment. Subsequent meetings in June and July were moved online. There isn't an opportunity for general public comment until August, and even that may look radically different. On Thursday, council members will discuss further changes to one of the few venues members of the public have for speaking face-to-face with their elected officials. These may seem like small shifts, but this is how democracy erodes quietly, unless we stand up and defend it. At the vigil, the ADL representative spoke of Jewish joy. But joy without humility isn't healing, it's indulgence. If we want to be proud of our identity, we must also be honest about what's being done in its name. Trauma doesn't absolve power. Our history should sharpen our moral vision, not blur it. Truth must come before comfort, especially if we claim to believe in justice. If we're truly students of Torah, let it show. Not through pageantry, slogans, or empty statements, but through courage. Courage to face the brokenness within our own community. Courage to stop using Jewish pain as cover for Jewish power. That's what Torah demands. My parents raised me to follow it with humility and conviction. As the prophet says, "What does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Because anything less isn't justice, it's moral theater." Misha K. Ben David is an Israeli veteran and resident of Boulder. This opinion does not necessarily represent the views of Boulder Weekly. Got another take? Send it to letters@boulderweekly.com. Make sure to read our guidelines first at bit.ly/opinionrulesbw. There's a photograph accompanying this article showing a group of people attending the Boulder Jewish Festival and March for Their Lives demonstration. Their backs are turned to the camera. Its camera angle is from the back of the gathering. There's several people, and one man in particular, the focus is on him, and he's wrapped in a flag, and the caption reads, "An attendee at the June 8th Boulder Jewish Festival and March for Their Lives demonstration wraps himself in an American Israel flag. Credit, Sagan Randall." From Analysis: when does criticism of Israel cross a line? A Primer on Anti-Semitism and Anti-Zionism by Joshua Shaines, The Conversation. Editor's note: this article was originally published by The Conversation in January 2024 and later updated to reflect the shifting dialogue around the anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. Boulder Weekly is republishing this explainer amid a similar debate in Boulder over the actions and beliefs of the June 1st attacker. Boulder City Council member Taisha Adams was harshly criticized for not signing a declaration condemning the attack as anti-Semitic, requesting instead that it be described as anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist. Other community members have also pushed back against the broad labeling of criticizing Israeli military action in Gaza as anti-Semitic. As part of Harvard University's agreement in response to two federal lawsuits filed by Jewish students alleging anti-Semitic discrimination, it will adopt the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, or IHRA, working definition of anti-Semitism. This is a definition favored by many Jewish community leaders and politicians because its broad language can be applied to most anti-Israel rhetoric. This includes Kenneth Marcus, who served as Assistant Secretary of Education during the first Trump administration and represented the students as chairman of the Louis D. Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law. In contrast, many scholars prefer either the competing Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism or the definition offered by the Nexus Task Force, a committee of experts led by the Bard Center for the Study of Hate. I am a member of the Nexus Group and also helped compose its 2024 Campus Guide to Identifying Anti-Semitism. The controversy over this move indicates that many well-intentioned people still struggle to understand what exactly constitutes anti-Semitism and when anti-Israel rhetoric crosses the line. As a scholar of modern Jewish history, I offer this primer that helps answer this question. History of anti-Semitism. There has been a sharp increase in anti-Semitism around the world since the October 7, 2023 massacre by Hamas and Israel's subsequent military attacks in the Gaza Strip. Anti-Jewish animosity dates to antiquity. The early Christian church attacked Jews, whom it blamed for crucifying Christ, and claimed to replace them as God's chosen people. The Gospel of John in the New Testament accused Jews of being Satan's children, while others called them demons intent on sacrificing the souls of men. Medieval Christians added other myths, such as the blood libel, the lie that Jews ritually murdered Christian children for their blood. Other myths accused them of poisoning wells or desecrating the consecrated host of the Eucharist to reenact the murder of Christ. Some even claimed that Jews had inhuman biology such as horns or that they suckled at the teats of pigs. Such lies led to violent persecution of Jews over many centuries. Modern anti-Semitism. In the 19th century, these myths were supplanted by the additional element of race. The claim that Jewishness was immutable and could not be changed by a conversion. Though this idea first appeared in 15th century Spain, it was deeply connected to the rise of modern nationalism. 19th century ethno-nationalists rejected the idea of a political nation united in a social contract with each other. They began imagining the nation as a biological community linked by common descent in which Jews might be tolerated but could never truly belong. Finally, in 1879, the German journalist Wilhelm Marr pushed the term anti-Semitism to reflect that his anti-Jewish ideology was based on race, not religion. Marr imagined the Jews as a foreign Semitic race, referring to the language group that includes Hebrew. The term has since persisted to mean specifically anti-Jewish hostility or prejudice. The myth of a Jewish conspiracy. Modern anti-Semitism built on those pre-modern foundations, which never completely disappeared, but was fundamentally different. It emerged as part of the new politics of the democratic modern era. Anti-Semitism became the core platform of new political parties, which used it to unite otherwise opposing groups, such as shopkeepers and farmers, anxious about the modernizing world. In other words, it was not merely prejudice. It was a worldview that explained the entire world to its believers by blaming all of its faults on this scapegoat. Unlike earlier anti-Jewish hatred, this was less about religion and more about political and social issues. Anti-Semites believed the conspiracy theory that Jews all over the world controlled the levers of government, media, and banking, and that defeating them would solve society's problems. Thus, one of the most important features of modern anti-Semitic mythology was the belief that Jews constituted a single malevolent group with one mind, organized for the purpose of conquering and destroying the world. Negative traits attributed to Jews. Anti-Semitic books and cartoons often used claws or tentacles to symbolize the international Jew, a shadowy figure they blame for leading a global conspiracy, strangling and destroying society. Others depicted him as a puppet master running the world. In the late 19th century, Edmund Rothschild, head of the most famous Jewish banking family, was villainized as the symbol of international Jewish wealth and nefarious power. Today, the billionaire liberal philanthropist George Soros is often portrayed in similar ways. This myth that Jews constitute an international creature plotting to harm the nation has inspired massacres of Jews since the 19th century, beginning with the Russian pogroms of 1881 and leading up to the Holocaust. More recently, in 2018, Robert Bowers murdered 11 Jews at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh because he was convinced that Jews, collectively under the guidance of Soros, were working to destroy America by facilitating the mass migration of non-white people into the country. Modern anti-Semites ascribe many immutable negative traits to Jews, but two are particularly widespread. First, Jews are said to be ruthless misers who care more about their allegedly ill-gotten wealth than the interests of their countries. Second, Jews' loyalty to their countries is considered suspect because they are said to constitute a foreign element. Since Israel's establishment in 1948, this hatred has focused on the accusation that Jews' primary loyalty is to Israel, not the countries they live in. Anti-Semitism and Anti-Zionism. In recent years, the relationship between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism has taken on renewed importance. Zionism has many factions but roughly refers to the modern political movement that argues Jews constitute a nation and have a right to self-determination in that land. Some activists claim that anti-Zionism, ideological opposition to Zionism, is inherently anti-Semitic because they equate it with denying Jews the right to self-determination and therefore equality. Others feel that there needs to be a clear separation between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. They argue that equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism leads to silencing criticism of Israel's structural mistreatment of Palestinians. Zionism in practice has meant the achievement of a flourishing safe haven for Jews, but it has also led to dislocation or inequality for millions of Palestinians, including refugees, West Bank Palestinians who still live under military rule, and even Palestinian citizens of Israel who face legal and social discrimination. Anti-Zionism opposes this, and critics argue that it should not be labeled anti-Semitic unless it taps into those anti-Semitic myths or otherwise calls for violence or inequality for Jews. This debate is evident in these competing definitions of anti-Semitism. Remarkably, the three main definitions tend to agree on the nature of anti-Semitism, except regarding the relationship of anti-Israel rhetoric to anti-Semitism. The IHRA definition, which is by design vague and open to interpretation, allows for a wider swath of anti-Israel activism to be labeled anti-Semitic than the others. The Jerusalem Declaration, in contrast, understands rhetoric to have crossed the line only when it engages in anti-Semitic mythology, blames diaspora Jews for the actions of the Israeli state, or calls for the oppression of Jews in Israel. IHRA defenders use that definition to label a call for binational democracy, meaning citizenship for West Bank Palestinians, to be anti-Semitic. Likewise, they label boycotts, even of West Bank settlements that most of the world considers illegal, to be anti-Semitic. The Jerusalem Declaration does not. In other words, the key to identifying whether anti-Israel discourse has masked anti-Semitism is to see evidence of anti-Semitic mythology. For example, if Israel is described as leading an international conspiracy, or if it holds the key to solving global problems, all three definitions agree this is anti-Semitic. Equally, If Jews or Jewish institutions are held responsible for Israeli actions or are expected to take a stand one way or another regarding them, again, all three definitions agree that this crosses the line because it is based on the myth of a global Jewish conspiracy. Identity and pride. Critically, for many Jews living in other countries, Zionism is not primarily a political argument about the state of Israel. It instead constitutes a sense of Jewish identity and pride, even a religious identity. In contrast, many protests against Israel and Zionism are focused not on ideology, but on the Israeli government and its real or alleged actions. This disconnect can lead to confusion if protests conflate Jews with Israel just because they are Zionist, which is anti-Semitic. On the other hand, Jews sometimes take protest against Israel in defense of Palestinian rights to be attacked, On the other hand, Jews sometimes take protest against Israel in defense of Palestinian rights to be attacks on their Zionist identity and thus anti-Semitic, when they are not. There are certainly gray areas, but in general, calls for Palestinian equality, I believe, are legitimate even when they upset people with Zionist identities. Harvard's statement captures this distinction. It posted a statement that, for many Jewish people, Zionism is a part of their Jewish identity, and added that Jews who subscribe to this identity must not be excluded from campus events on that basis. This does not mean that Jews are protected from hearing contrary views any more than they are protected from hearing Christian preachers on campus or professors who teach secular views of the Bible. It means that they cannot be excluded based only on those beliefs. This does not, however, require an adoption of the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which goes much further. Many advocates of the IHRA definition use it to label political calls for Palestinian equality as anti-Semitic, as well as accusations against Israel that they consider wrong or unfair. Harvard's adoption of the IHRA definition, accordingly, would mean that any speech that calls for full equality for Palestinians risks academic and legal sanction, even without any material discrimination against Jewish students. It is thus opposed by students who advocate for Palestinian rights, as well as supporters of free speech more generally. Joshua Shaines is a professor of Jewish studies at College of Charleston. This article is republished from The Conversation, an independent nonprofit media outlet featuring the work of academic experts under a Creative Commons license. Read the original article at bit.ly/antisemitismexplainer. This article is accompanied by two photographs. The first shows attendees of a protest. Most all of them are blocked out by a large sign, large cardboard sign, and it reads, "Anti-Zionism does not equal anti-Semitism." The not equal is actually an equal sign with a line through it. And the caption reads, "There are several accepted definitions of anti-Semitism being used by organizations today, but they disagree over whether and to what extent criticisms of Israel should be considered anti-Semitic, an issue complicated by the country's ongoing military action in Gaza." Credit Sagan Randall. The second photograph is a scene from a Boulder street. There are two demonstrators holding signs. One reads, "Judaism is sacred, Zionism is genocidal." The other sign reads, "Being anti-genocide is not anti-Semitic." In the background is a prana shop. There are people walking around in the background, and one of the protesters appears to be holding his cell phone camera towards a lady who has her back to the camera, and they appear to be conversing. And the caption reads, "Pro-Palestinian demonstrators hold signs at the June 8th Boulder Jewish Festival held in downtown Boulder just 1 week after the June 1st attack on demonstrators advocating for the release of Israeli hostages taken by Hamas on October 7th, 2023. Credit, Sagan Randall. In music, a big statement. Colorado Music Festival approaches half a century with robust program of contrast by Kelly Dean Hansen. Next year is set to be a big one for milestones. During the Colorado Music Festival's 50th anniversary at Chautauqua Auditorium in the summer of 2026, the U.S. will celebrate its 250th birthday and Colorado its 150th. Music director Peter Aungian says the landmark season of the annual 5-week classical music concert series at Chautauqua Auditorium is mostly planned out, and the path leading there begins this summer. He sees the upcoming festival beginning July 3rd as a launching point. That's particularly true when it comes to the conclusion the first weekend of August with two Immortal Ninth Symphonies, both the last completed by their composers, Ludwig van Beethoven and Gustav Mahler. Knowing the 50th anniversary was coming up, I wanted to make the 49th seem significant, Aungian says. Doing these two symphonies on the closing weekend felt like a massive celebration and a big statement, and the contrast is fantastic. Beethoven's Ninth ends with a grand choral finale, the first in the symphonic literature, and Mahler's fades into eternity, an illustration of death in music. The symphonies are both farewells to many things, Aungian says. The Beethoven piece will be heard July 31st and August 1st, with Mahler following August 3rd. Mahler's work stands on its own, but the Beethoven concerts will have a brief opening half. With Denver's St. Martin's Festival singers on hand, Aungian is having them present Beethoven's short elegiac song, and the orchestra will play a commissioned world premiere, Amplify, by composer Michael Abels. Not a normal concert. Aungian likes to open the festival with a major guest artist playing a major concerto, a role filled this year by French pianist Helene Grimaud. Considered an extraordinary pianist in person by Aungian, she has been on the world's biggest stages for more than 30 years. She plays the tremendous and dramatic First Piano Concerto by Johann Brahms, whose first movement alone is of titanic scope. The concert also celebrates the 150th birthday of French composer Maurice Ravel, with Aungian directing the second ballet suite from Daphnis et Chloe and the extremely familiar Bolero. You don't really program Bolero in a normal concert, Aungian says, noting its place in popular culture ranging from The Three Stooges to Futurama. With the anniversary, it is appropriate, and the Brahms gives the concert its substance. Stravinsky's orchestral fantasy, Feu d'Artifice, Fireworks, opens the program and the festival. Another Brahms first anchors the following orchestral program July 10th and 11th. The First Symphony was written much later than the concerto. Hearing them in consecutive weeks will be fascinating, Aungian says. The program includes another world premiere, a saxophone concerto by renowned composer Joan Tower. Joan is becoming a face of the festival at this point and seems almost like my older sister, Aungyeon says. An entire program of her music, including a world premiere, an unusual feat for a living composer, was presented by the festival in 2021. Saxophonist Stephen Banks also amazed the audience in 2021, so Aungyeon brought them together. They hit it off so well, and I asked her to compose a concerto for his instrument, Aungyeon says. The new work is titled Love Returns. The concert opens with an outdoor overture by Aaron Copland, another composer with a significant birth anniversary, his 125th. Part of the community. Ravel appears again on the program for July 17th and 18th with guest violinist Anne Akiko Myers playing his virtuoso work, Zygaine. She plays one of the greatest violins ever made, Aungyeon says of Myers, who also plays the second performance of Eric Whiteacre's Murmur, which he wrote for her. The piece became a memorial to the January fires in Los Angeles, where Whiteacre has spent much of his life. This concert opens with Copland's ubiquitous Appalachian Spring. For the second half, Aungyeon conducts two overtures with a Shakespeare theme, Tchaikovsky's very well-known Romeo and Juliet fantasy overture, and Berlioz's lesser-known overture to his opera, Beatrice et Benedict. Besides the closing Mahler concert, Aungyeon directs one other Sunday event, July 27th, featuring guitarist Zufei Yang playing Rodrigo's Concierto de Aranjuez. We don't do guitar concertos very often, and that's kind of a shame, Aungyeon says. The Rodrigo piece works well with Zoltán Kodály's Dances of Galanta, which opens the program, he says. They both have a rustic quality and come from different parts of Europe, Hungary, and Spain. The program closes with Franz Schubert's delightful Fifth Symphony, which Aungyeon calls one of the most perfect pieces ever written. With this program on the near horizon and a major milestone around the corner, Aungyeon is now a solid fixture in Colorado. This year, he was officially named music director of the Colorado Symphony Orchestra in Denver after serving as principal conductor. I really feel part of the community now, he says. I'm extremely excited for this summer, and I have all the scores spread out on my floor. I really want every festival to seem like my favorite. On the bill, the Colorado Music Festival 2025 season opener featuring pianist Helene Grimaud, 7:30 p.m. Thursday, July 3rd, and 6:30 p.m. Sunday, July 6, Chautauqua Auditorium, 900 Baseline Road, Boulder, $23 to $100.50. There's a photograph accompanying this article showing Aungyeon directing some musicians. There are two prominently in the picture. One is a violinist in the background. The other is a pianist in the foreground with his back to the camera. Aungyeon is looking at him. His arms are raised as he's conducting. And the caption reads, "Knowing the 50th anniversary was coming up, I wanted to make the 49th seem significant," says Colorado Music Festival director Peter Aungyeon. Credit, Jeremy Kornreich. In news, Government Watch, What Your Local Officials Are Up To This Week, by Boulder Weekly Staff. Boulder City Council. On June 26, Council will discuss further changes to open comment, the period preceding regular business meetings in which members of the public can speak for 2 minutes on a topic of their choosing. Council has faced disruption over the past several months as participants use open comment to speak on Israel's ongoing military action in Gaza that has resulted in more than 54,000 Palestinian deaths. Meetings have been forced to pause several times, and Council suspended open comment at its June 5th meeting, the first to follow the June 1st attack on a Boulder group advocating for the release of Israeli hostages. Council last year passed limits on the size and display of signs in response to the upheaval. Since then, at least three speakers have been temporarily suspended from speaking at council meetings for violations. Council also instituted time limits on their own members' response to open comment offered at the end of meetings. In May of this year, Councilman Matt Benjamin suggested moving open comment to the end of meetings. Other suggestions, emailed by various council members this week, include shortening the length of open comment, prioritizing speakers who have not participated in recent meetings, limiting what topics can be addressed, restricting open comment to only City of Boulder residents, further reducing the amount of time council members have to respond, and longer bans for speakers who violate rules. Currently, council is issuing 30-day bans. The discussion will be held after public hearings on the historic landmark of 3375 16th Street and updates to neighborhood parking permit programs and discussion of polling results for potential tax-related ballot measures, according to a meeting agenda. Lafayette City Council. At its June 24th work session, Council discussed a November ballot issue to raise property taxes for a 20-year bond to fund a renovation and expansion of the Bob Berger Recreation Center and the Parks and Public Works Service Center, and to build a new civic center on city-owned land on South Public Road. Council agreed to ask the voters for funding for the BBRC and Service Center, but were split on including the Civic Center, with some expressing concern over the uncertain economy and others not wanting to kick the can down the road for future councils. Council will vote on the ballot language at a June 30th council meeting. Council also received a financial update in preparation for the beginning of the 2026 budget discussion in August. Due to uncertain economic conditions and slower revenue growth, staff plan to take a conservative approach to 2026 revenue projections. Sales and use tax, the city's largest source of discretionary revenue at $21.7 million, was flat in 2024. Staff indicated that King Soopers' move to Erie, despite a revenue-sharing agreement, had an impact on tax collection. Property tax was $15.2 million in 2024, up 25% from 2023 due to reassessed property values. Assessment of additional city fees is also underway. All agenda items subject to change. Karen Norback contributed reporting. The photograph that accompanies this article is simply the chamber of City of Boulder. It's empty. There are just chairs lined up. American flag to the left, appears to be a Colorado flag to the right, and it says courtesy City of Boulder. BOCO Briefly, Local News at a Glance, by Kaylee Harder. NAACP sues former local branch members. The National NAACP has sued former directors and executive members of the organization's Boulder County branch in the latest development in the conflict between the national and local organizations. Executive members of the Boulder branch voted to dissolve the branch in March, something the national org says the local branch lacks the authority to do. The suit asks for a declaratory judgment that the branch has not been legally dissolved and for all the branch's assets to remain with the National NAACP. Those assets include a checking account with $77,000 and $25,000 in Google stock, according to the suit. Defendant and former Boulder County NAACP Treasurer Veronica Summers ignored multiple requests from the administrator and or NAACP to turn over the accounts, according to the suit. According to the Colorado Secretary of State's website, the branch has been legally dissolved since April 25th. As far as we know, it's done, former Vice President Judith Landsman, who is a defendant in the suit, told Boulder Weekly in April. And if NAACP National wants to push it, then they'll have to challenge it legally. The 13 defendants named in the suit, filed June 16th in U.S. District Court, also include former NAACP of Boulder County President Annette James and former Criminal Justice Chair Darren O'Connor, who said in an email to Boulder Weekly they are not making any statements at this time. The conflict began in 2021, according to the suit, when members of the Boulder branch engaged in conduct which was inimical to the best interest of the NAACP, and leadership showed a continued pattern of refusal to abide by the NAACP constitution and bylaws. The Boulder branch has previously said the decision to disband stemmed from its ongoing dispute with the city of Boulder. The group opposed Stephen Redfern's 2024 appointment as police chief and had repeatedly called for his resignation. The messy conflict included the branch releasing a partial transcript of a meeting with the police chief and city officials, and the city previously filing a complaint about executive members of the Boulder branch with the National NAACP for secretly recording the meeting and threatening to release it if Redfern were appointed. The group accused the city of a relentless campaign to discredit and undermine and ultimately destroy our branch. According to the suit, all defendants have been suspended by the national org and have been divested of all authority to act on behalf of the branch or NAACP. The national branch also claims that the Boulder branch's actions effectively halted donations through the website and stopped new members from joining. The complaint accuses the defendants of breaching fiduciary duty, conversion, civil theft, and civil conspiracy. In other news, the Boulder Safeway at 3325 28th Street has joined at least 20 other Colorado stores in an ongoing unfair labor practices strike. The strike began June 15th. A federal judge ruled last week that the hate crime charge in the June 1st Pearl Street attack can move forward. The attacker now faces 9 hate crime charges, with prosecutors arguing he targeted his victims based on actual or perceived national origin. The Longmont Herald, an independent community newsletter and Substack covering Longmont, is taking a pause, its founder, Adam Steininger, announced June 21st. "It's been a bumpy road, financially and emotionally," he wrote in the announcement. "I've sacrificed a lot, probably too much, to try to make this work. And despite my best efforts, the Herald hasn't yet reached the point where it can support me in return." In events, June 26, Pride Rainbow Roll, 7 to 9 p.m. Thursday, June 26, Skate City, Westminster, 200 West 121st Avenue, $7 entry, $5 skate rental. Strap on your rainbow wheels and roll down to Skate City in Westminster for a night of pride. Bring your own skates if you're a pro, or rent on location if you're just rink curious, for this community event brought to you by Rocky Mountain Equality. There is a picture, artwork, showing a man and a woman on skates with rainbow flags flying around them, and down below that picture is a picture of the rainbow flag. June 26, Boulder history is LGBTQ plus history. 5 to 6:30 p.m. Thursday, June 26, Carnegie Library for Local History, 1125 Pine Street, Boulder, free. Send Pride Month off in style during this Carnegie Library event exploring local LGBTQ plus history. A short presentation covers the ins and outs of historical documentation, followed by a diverse panel of experts who will discuss the importance of preservation and research in an illuminating discussion, recognizing that LGBTQ plus history is and has always been part of the history of Boulder and Boulder County. There's a picture, also artwork, of a person's face looking off in the distance with a background of the rainbow colors, and down below that is a picture of the rainbow flag. June 26, Yoga Pearl X, Boulder Symphony, 6 to 7 p.m. Thursday, June 26, Sunrise Theater, 1198 Flagstaff Drive, Boulder, $20 to $30. Picture yourself on your yoga mat high atop a Boulder mountain, the gentle breeze on your skin as you flow slowly through gentle movements, the buzz of bees, chirps of bird, and the soft strings of a Boulder Symphony Quartet as your soundtrack. Stay after class for some socializing with snacks and mocktails, the perfect way to wind down your week. And there's a photograph of a lady. It's a silhouette type picture with the sky and sun in the background, and she is in a yoga pose. June 26, 50 plus LGBTQ plus mixer, 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, June 26, Equality Center of the Rocky Mountains, 3340 Mitchell Lane, Boulder, free. Dance, mingle, and enjoy some light refreshments during this 50 and up LGBTQ plus mixer co-hosted by Rainbow Elders and the Boulder County Area Agency on Aging. Whether you're looking for a love connection or new friends, this social event is a great way to put yourself out there and meet others in the community. And that is accompanied by a photograph. It has three people. One lady in the background, and she's holding what appears to maybe be a fan. And a lady to the left. She's looking off into the distance, and there's a man in the lower right corner wearing a straw hat. He has a mustache and goatee and wearing glasses, and he's got a smile on his face, and he's looking toward the camera. There's also a small pride flag at the bottom of that picture. Boulder Comedy Festival. Various times and locations throughout Boulder County. Prices vary. BOCO's flagship stand-up fest returns for another year of laughs. Now in its fifth year of celebrating women and diversity in comedy, this year's bill includes Janae Burris, Ricky Ramos, Niraj Srinivasan, and more at Dairy Arts Center, The End Lafayette, Junkyard Social, and Louisville Underground. Schedule and pricing at bouldercomedyfestival.com. That event is accompanied by a photograph of nine different comedians in various poses. Some are headshots. Some show them just standing before a microphone or just holding a microphone. Thank you for joining us for the Boulder Weekly, read by Bill Bass.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at
www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of Aftersight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Boulder Weekly, contact letters@boulderweekly.com or call 303-494-5511.